Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us today is Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome. Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News.
Welcome back to the work week.
Thank you. That's more like it. And Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Good morning.
A federal judge has rejected a plea from opponents of the nuclear bailout law to get more time to collect signatures. Instead, the judge has asked the Ohio Supreme Court for its opinion. Opponents of the bailout claim they weren't given the full 90 days to collect signatures because of how long it took to get approval from the Ohio Secretary of State and Attorney General. Laura Bischoff, this must be typical because the way things have always proceeded at or for any period of time now has been you put your referendum language before the Attorney General and the Secretary of State. That's always been the way, right?
Right. And you know, the last couple of times that this has happened has been the Senate Bill 5 referendum back in 2011 and the payday lending law referendum back in 2008. The thing is, you know, Ohioans have had the right to referenda since 1912 Constitution. And I think it's only with referenda that you have this 90-day clock. If you go with a citizen-initiated statute or a constitutional amendment, you have a bigger window in which to gather all these signatures.
And this 90-day clock starts because that's 90 days before the bill takes effect, technically, right?
Right. The bill unless there's an emergency clause added to a bill takes effect 90 days after the governor signs it. So the governor signs it on July 23rd, and boom, the clock starts. And so the question is, if the Constitution guarantees a 90 days collection window, then the state law requiring referenda groups to go get their approval from the AG and the Secretary of State, that eats into that 90 days. And in this instance, it was 38 days were consumed by kind of the back and forth.
Just waiting and...
Well, they submitted one version and got rejected, and then they submitted another version. And so it just took a little bit longer. So the federal judge, Ed Sargas, certified a number of questions and sent it to the Ohio Supreme Court. They put it on the docket. And I think that the referendum campaign is also going to file. I'm not sure how that works.
In addition to the judge.
Right.
Referring it to the Ohio Supreme Court.
As I understand it, there's kind of a docket open so that the questions – there are two of the questions that I think they're looking at that could be examined by the Ohio Supreme Court. But as I understand it, the group – Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts, the group that wanted to put this issue on the ballot, they went to federal court instead of to the Ohio Supreme Court in the first place because they felt they might have a better chance in federal court with some of the issues that they wanted to raise instead of going to the state court. Of course, now they have to because – that's what Judge Ed Sargas said, that they had to the Ohio Supreme Court was the better venue to take up some of these issues.
Well, what about that venue issue, Marty Schladen? I mean, I have asked about this a couple times. What were the thoughts going into this, putting it before a federal judge when it's state law related?
Well, I think that's exactly what Judge Sargas told them. What Karen's saying is probably right, that they thought that they have stood a better chance in federal court, maybe not least of all because of politics. You know, the Ohio Supreme Court is dominated by Republicans, and statewide Republicans have supported House Bill 6. I don't know what their calculation was, but they're back in front of the Supreme Court now.
Well, and they had 20 days, I guess, after the decision from Judge Sargas to take this to federal court or to the Ohio Supreme Court. They have about 15 days left. The question is now, I think, will they actually do it? Even though there is this opening for them to do it, and this would be the next venue, there's the real question of if they have enough time to go ahead and get all these signatures. And they were fairly short. I mean, they probably needed a half a million signatures overall to make sure that they got the 266,000 valid signatures.
Right.
So whether they've got the time to get those signatures, whether they've got the money to make that happen, these are all real issues that they have to address before they take this to the Ohio Supreme Court, if they do.
Laura Bischoff, does this mean the law? I know the Secretary of State put out a press release last week saying, okay, the law is going into effect now.
It is in effect.
It is in effect. Has any money changed hands since it is a bailout?
You know, I think there's like a delay built into the law.
The subsidies, we're talking $150 million in subsidies for the two nuclear power plants owned by First Energy Solutions, and then also subsidies possible for two coal-fired power plants. I believe those subsidies go into effect in 2021. But the issue for First Energy Solutions, they had said that if the law did not go into effect, then they were going to have to consider proceeding with their plans to shut down those two nuclear power plants because they've said all along that they needed these subsidies to continue to operate. Though it's been brought up that during the whole discussion about House Bill 6, which is what brought this thing forward, that there were several deadlines that they said, hey, House Bill 6 has to pass by this point, and it didn't. And yet the power plants kept operating.
And it's not the first time something like House Bill 6 has been put forward. They've been looking for this for a while now.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes back at least a couple of years. I remember Senator John Eklund, who's from Geauga County and the area that includes the First Energy Solutions power plant. That's Perry. So, he had proposed a subsidy proposal based on the whole idea that this is carbon neutral energy. And it is something to consider that 15% of Ohio's electricity grid does come from nuclear power plants. And they'll tell you that 90% of that 15% is carbon free. So, you know, that they're producing 90% of the carbon or of that part there. But, you know, obviously there's some people who are very concerned about how First Energy is going to use this money and whether they're whether they even need it at all.
Well, and I think that people need to not lose sight of the fact that this is a bailout of a bankrupt company that's already gotten $10 billion in public money, yet this political campaign we've just lived through, I don't even know how many millions of dollars were spent trying to knock down this petition effort.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts, the pro-referendum anti-House Bill 6 group, estimates that the other side spent $50 million, and that includes ads and lobbying to get the bill passed, and then ads and petitions to block it from going on the ballot.
But we won't know. We won't know.
Because that's dark. The Ohioans Against Nuclear Bailouts, we will find out where their money came from. How that was spent or how much was spent.
And it's all due to the way that these groups file as, I mean, they're LLCs, but also Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts is a ballot issue PAC. And so they will have to disclose certain expenditures and donations. But, you know, I don't think we'll ever have a real total of how much was spent here like we would if this were a political candidate or something.
And this, the tone of this campaign to even get it on the ballot,
I know. It's so complicated. When I try to explain it to people, it's like you need a scorecard to keep track of everybody here.
But the tone of the campaign was one of the most vitriolic ever. And it's the first time in anyone's memory that the battle has been waged before it's even made it to the ballot over getting it on the ballot. And the tactics used were unprecedented, as far as I'm sure. And I've been following evil politics for a long time.
There have been decline to sign campaigns to try to prevent people from going to the ballot. I think there was a decline to sign over the Internet cafe issue.
There have been. But
not to this degree.
And I think one of the great ironies of all time is that the pro House Bill 6 people, the whole, at least the tenor of the campaign when it started out was the Chinese are going to take over the electricity grid. And because it's a dark money group, that entire campaign might have been financed by the Chinese government.
For all we know.
We'll never know.
And there's another irony here, too, that I think is interesting, is during the whole debate on House Bill 6, there was a group, the opponents of House Bill 6 had said that they thought that this might be a tax. Well, then when the people who support the bailout went to the Ohio Supreme Court to try to stop this whole thing, they made the argument that, yes, it is a tax. So they made the argument that had just been used against them.
And why is that pertinent?
Because voters do not get the opportunity to vote on whether a tax should be in front of them or not, like this.
Right.
So we're still waiting for the Ohio Supreme Court to rule on that, which would be very interesting. But, you know, that's just another thing that's potentially here that's still out there that we don't know.
Is there any sense that the Supreme Court's going to take action on any of this in a
Well, I know that the question about whether this is a tax or not is on their regular docket. It was not moved forward in sort of an emergency case or whatever. Uh-huh. So it could be a while before we know that one.
But when Judge Sargas asked the Supreme Court to look over his four questions,
I think Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts has to make that action. And I think they have about 15 days to do that.
Okay.
Otherwise, it just I think it kind of dies there.
So
this other case about whether or not it's a tax or it's a rate increase, if the surcharges that are added to your electricity bill for the nuclear power bailout,
about $1.85 a household,
there's a debate about if it's a tax or a rate increase, and that's because the right of referendum does not apply to legislation that has an appropriation, a tax or a budget item.
Okay. You said that much better than I.
And I think there's 3 members of the 7-member Ohio Supreme Court that have recused themselves in that case because I think some of the players involved were involved in their campaigns.
Huh. So I really wonder if this is going to be a political issue going into next year. I was outside the Democratic debate in Westerville earlier this month, and the people gathering signatures were being tracked down. And this did not seem to have a terribly big partisan bent. As it turns out, bailouts for big, rich corporations are not all that popular in this country.
And you know, you're talking about people being tracked down. I think you're talking about people wanting to sign.
Yeah, that's what I'm – I'm sorry I wasn't clear about that.
No, no, no. And I think that that's been a frustration of people who wanted to sign, who wanted it to go to the ballot, that there was the group that supported the bailout that was trying to find these petition circulators to monitor them, as they put it, but also to block them, to keep people physically from signing these petitions. And they also had their own informal petition that they were circulating that said, hey, we love this bill. We want to stop foreign investment in our electricity grid. They turned in their informal petition, which has no force of law, doesn't do anything. They say they got 849,000 signatures or whatever. And now 2 representatives who were involved in House Bill 6 have turned that into a resolution that they want to propose, saying that there shouldn't be foreign investment in Ohio's electricity grid. And my colleague Andy Chow asked the governor about that on Friday, and he kind of looked at Andy like, well, we welcome foreign investment in Ohio. That's fine. So I'll be interested to see what happens with that.
Yeah, that's Don Manning and Jamie Callender. Their resolution is for a constitutional amendment to go on the ballot so Ohio voters would vote on it. On about whether or not we can have foreign investment in critical infrastructure.
Then there's another piece of the argument, the anti-referendum people, that they try to scare people into thinking that the information they give when they sign a petition is somehow nefariously had. And that's just stuff that if they're a voter and a registered voter, that's the same information that's in the
it's public. Already public information.
Yeah, it's already. Yeah.
I found that a little bit objectionable. People exercising their constitutional rights in a democracy, and this was trying to scare them from doing that.
I wonder how many people it worked for.
I don't know. And they also had a campaign that they were trying to tell people, if you sign the petition and you now wish you hadn't, well, we can find a way to get your signature off the petition, which is pretty extraordinary, too. I mean, I think there was a lot of fear that was weighing in here. Fear mongering. I know that I had gotten some emails from people in the Chinese American community who had said they were very concerned about the tone of this campaign. And then the whole ad that featured somebody shot through a Ring camera, you know, or some sort of doorbell monitor, you know, this shady person on your front doorstep. What do they want? They want your personal information. I mean, it was really kind of extraordinary, but, you know, I do wonder, I don't know that you'll ever be able to find out, though, how many people didn't sign because of that, because you don't know what you don't know.
I know it had some effect because a guy I spoke to in Westerville gathering signatures, he had a big long beard, and he said, I'm not the guy to go door to door. We have, you know, less dangerous looking people going door to door.
Pick somebody more wholesome looking.
Yes.
We chuckle.
If we drag this on, he could wear a Santa outfit and go door to door, you know. Who's going to turn away
Santa?
Kidding.
We will continue with our weekly reporter roundtable. It's Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Laura Bischoff, Dayton Daily News state government reporter, and Marty Schladen, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. The Stand Your Ground bill has been revived in the Ohio General Assembly, notably, I believe, in the Ohio House. And I'm wondering about the timing of that versus the timing of the governor's, you know, much ballyhooed plan to, you know, for the pink slip law and more following the mass shooting in Dayton in August. So, Karen Kassler, what about this? I mean, we've already heard kind of a nonplussed Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, regarding the governor's plan, and now this.
Well, this is almost exactly the same bill that was proposed last year. There was a Stand Your Ground bill that was proposed last year. Then Governor John Kasich said he wouldn't sign it. It was the Stand Your Ground kind of provisions were stripped out of it, and it passed the House and Senate. He vetoed it anyway. They overrode him. But then there was another version of that Stand Your Ground bill that was proposed, and lawmakers either, depending on who you talk to, ran out of time, or there was no way that they were going to be able to consider it because the governor had already said he was going to veto it. So now you've got Representative Candace Keller and Representative Ron Hood, both conservative Republicans, hardcore gun rights advocates who want to see this go through. And they've proposed this. And I talked to Candace Keller about it. And she said, and specifically asked her, is now the time? Senator Matt Dolan, who's carrying Governor DeWine's so-called Strong Ohio bill, he has said that it is not the time for this, that he feels that it's tone deaf to talk about Stand Your Ground and what some people call constitutional carry, which is carrying a concealed weapon without the permit. He said it's tone deaf to consider those right now with everything that's going on. And she says, no, now is the time to be considering this bill, because every gun bill that we're looking at should get careful consideration, including this one. So it's interesting that she's proposing it now. But I think there seems to be a lot of support for it.
Stand Your Ground, though, it's been in the Ohio General Assembly before, though, hasn't it, Laura Bischoff?
Yeah, it's long been on the wish list for gun rights groups. And it's I think it might have a better chance of passing this time around. The governor has not said in the past, he said he has supported something like this. He has been silent on House Bill 381 and whether or not he would support it. They say that they need to read the details of the bill.
This is the Stand Your Ground.
The Stand Your Ground, yeah. Right. And the gun rights people prefer to call it repealing the duty to retreat. Right now, if you are in a public place and you're legally there, you have a duty to retreat from danger before using deadly force. So if you're in a park and you have a chance to run away from danger, that's what you're legally obligated to do before you use deadly force in self-defense. And this would remove that duty. And about 10 or 11 years ago, Ohio passed what's called the Castle Doctrine, mm-hmm. which removes the duty to retreat while in your home or in an occupied vehicle when you face, you know, serious injury or the threat of death, and you can use self-defense in those conditions. And the last year, after that Stand Your Ground bill got watered down, the piece that did pass was changing the burden of proof from the defendant to say, I used self-defense because I had no option to retreat, blah, blah, blah. They shifted it to the prosecutor has to prove. The burden of proof got switched to the mm-hmm. to the prosecution, and that lines Ohio back up with like 49 other states. Hmm. But this Stand Your Ground, like I said, it would expand the Castle Doctrine to be any place in which you are legally allowed to be in a public setting.
And they also say that 36 states have this, and so that they want Ohio to join this group. Like Laura said, it's been out there for a while, and I think that. I'm just interested to see what might happen with this, with DeWine's bill. When I talked to Senator Dolan, again, he's the one who's carrying DeWine's bill. He had said specifically that he hoped those bills, Stand Your Ground and Constitutional Carry, don't go anywhere, but then said he hopes that they also are not attached to that Strong Ohio bill, which that's interesting if that would happen, where Stand Your Ground would be attached to this bill that is designed to curb gun violence.
Hmm. What would the governor do, Marty Schleiden?
Laura and I were talking about this just a few minutes ago, and it probably puts the governor in a box. He's got this, you know, he's got this great imperative to do something, as the crowd in Dayton called upon him to do right after the mass shooting there. He's had a hard time getting even what this package forward, and people, Republicans in the legislature, have voiced some opposition to it. So this might be his only opportunity to do anything. And where does that leave the vast majority of Ohioans who seem to want more? That's another question.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Marty Schleiden of the Columbus Dispatch also with us, Karen Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. We're talking about gun laws right now, and I'm kind of curious as far as because the governor did not put out a red flag law, did not do something stronger than what he did. A group is now working to collect signatures for a ballot, for the ballot in 2020. And notably, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley has joined the fray, right, Laura Bischoff? And that is notable.
Right. Nan Whaley, mayor of Dayton. I think Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley also endorsed the effort.
Okay.
You know, they have to collect, I think, 125,000 signatures in the first batch for a citizen-initiated statute. And then the legislature gets either 90 days or 180 days to either pass it, amend it and pass it, or ignore it. And if they amend it or ignore it, then the group has an opportunity to take it to go back to the voters and get another 125,000 unique signatures. You can't mm-hmm. repeat. And then put it on the ballot in November of 2020. And, I think it's one of these issues. If it makes a ballot, it's likely to pass. The polls show that there's 90 to 95% of Americans favor universal background checks.
And I think a lot of Democrats would like to see it on the ballot in 2020 because obviously it's a presidential election year. And they feel that that's an issue that I think that they really own, the whole idea of universal background checks. And it is interesting to note that DeWine did say after the Dayton event, he had a press conference at the State House where he was standing there with the lieutenant governor and the first lady saying, people in Dayton told me to do something. I want to do something. He called on the legislature to pass mandatory background checks. But then the bill that he proposed did not include mandatory background checks. And it's simply probably because they wouldn't pass. And so also the same with this red flag law. This is a version of a red flag law. It would update what's called the pink slip law that allows people to be involuntarily hospitalized right now for mental health crises conditions, but they want to add substance abuse disorders to that. When I talked to Senator Dolan about that, he said, you know, there is an issue with space and treatment space in Ohio, and we are working on other bills that would try to free up some treatment space so that this version of a red flag law could go into effect and people could actually get some treatment.
Hmm. You know, I think that the governor didn't go with universal background checks as a proposal because it would not pass the House or the Senate. And it's in part because you have people who are, you know, extremely absolutist about the Second Amendment you know, this, for example, the Stand Your Ground bill has 24 co-sponsors. You know, that's almost halfway to what you need to get it to pass. And, you know, its primary sponsor, Candace Keller from Middletown, just maybe a day or so after the I think it was the day following the shooting, she posted something very controversial on her Facebook page that blamed the mass shooting on the breakdown of the traditional American family.
Oh, yeah.
Fatherlessness, athletes who protest the flag or, you know, kneel during the national anthem, recreational marijuana, failed school policies, et cetera. And, you know, she's
gay marriage, I think.
Gay marriage, drag queens, et cetera. So the legislature, even though 95% of voters in America favor background checks, the legislature is packed with very conservative pro-gun lawmakers.
And that post was very controversial when it happened. You even had Republicans saying that she should resign, including the sheriff of Butler County, who's a pretty strong conservative Republican. And I think there was even... Didn't Jane Timken, the chair of the Ohio Republican Party, weigh in saying that she should resign? And she didn't resign. So I know there were a lot of concerns about that post. And then one that followed not long after that, I think from John Becker, another conservative Republican in the legislature, kind of echoing some of those same kinds of things. So, yeah, there's support for Stand Your Ground and other methods to actually strengthen and increase gun rights.
A question I get all the time, I'm sure you guys do too, is why, when 90% of Ohioans support mandatory background checks, does the Ohio General Assembly, why is that not a no-brainer for the Ohio General Assembly then to enact such a law? Marty Schladen, where's the disconnect?
It's how these legislative and congressional districts on a national level are drawn. They're drawn in such a way that there's a very important part of the Republican coalition that is very motivated around gun rights. And these people vote in primaries. They vote in, you know, every election there is. And they the people who support these laws over the popular opinion, they see themselves as, you know, they need those voters in order to succeed.
And I think Laura even mentioned it, too, that there are people who are absolutist about the Second Amendment, that they believe this is a right that cannot be infringed, and they're going to stand up and fight for it. And they are elected in the state house. They're sitting in those seats in the House and Senate. So that's why.
Oftentimes we don't see politicians loosen up on gun rights until they are term limited or, you know, 1 foot out the door. John Kasich was, you know, in the last year of his 8 years as governor, and that's when he started calling for gun control. It was, you know, shortly after the Parkland shooting in Florida in which 17 people died. And Peggy Lehner, who's a Republican from Kettering, has joined Democrats to call for stricter gun controls. She is term limited and will not be, you know, won't be returning to the state house after this year.
Marty Schladen?
Yeah, I just think that whenever we talk about Stand Your Ground, there needs to be some context here. If everybody remembers Trayvon Martin in Florida, proponents of the bill say this is a way to protect yourself when you feel like you're under attack. But in that instance, you had a guy who was a self-appointed neighborhood cop, and he went after a teenager, a black teenager in a hoodie who had Skittles in his pocket, and ended up killing him. And Stand Your Ground was what he used as a defense in court, and he got off. So that's another possible consequence of this law. And I think that people need to remember that.
I just wanted to add to what Laura just said here. People who make some of these statements, Congressman Mike Turner, Republican congressman from the Dayton area, his daughter was across the street from where the shooting happened in Dayton. And he came out and said, maybe we need to reconsider these laws.
He called for an assault weapons ban. Yeah. His daughter was across the street in the district where the shooting happened.
So there's also sometimes the minds get changed because things do hit home and become personal. On John Kasich, I think it's interesting to note that he was running for president at the time, and certainly polls were starting to swing toward things like background checks and that sort of thing. And I vividly remember him being live on the air on CNN talking about his stance on gun control, which had changed dramatically. And at the same time, his website was changing from a whole section defending the Second Amendment to common sense on the Second Amendment. He had done a real dramatic change and really didn't seem to have a whole lot of explanation at first to it, kind of like, this is where I am. And later on, we started to realize that, you know, Parkland was part of that and everything. But he had signed every piece of gun rights legislation that had been put in front of him before that.
A note that's getting struck lately more and more is the notion of a well-regulated militia, and the idea that with emphasis on well-regulated. And most of the gun rights, you know, the hardcore gun rights people tend to not want any regulation at all.
The absolutists, like Laura was talking about.
I talk to a lot of gun rights people outside the Democratic debate, and I've even gotten in some thoughtful email exchanges. And one thing that I've seen is they just kind of want to whistle past that. One gentleman...
They want to forget those words.
Yeah.
Well regulated.
One gentleman was trying to use a passage from one of the Federalist Papers to say that those regulations wouldn't come from the government, and that's not what Alexander Hamilton intended. And, you know, and it only took like 5 seconds on the Google to come up with a letter that Hamilton wrote in 1780-something where he said expressly that the government is the one who
should regulate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hamilton was on the internet?
He was way, way, way ahead of his time.
Yes. He invented it.
You know, a lot of the gun rights groups, they don't want universal background checks because they believe that it's a step toward a national registry, gun registry, which would then allow the government to know who's got which guns where and able to seize them in
because
tyranny.
Because of that. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
I was going to make one quick point. Even though Mike Turner changed his mind on gun issues, you know, there have been shootings in which, like, Gabby Giffords was shot in the head in mm-hmm. Arizona, or Steve Scalise and other members of Congress are shot at a softball practice. And those shootings, even though it touched very close to home to them, did not change minds of members of Congress.
Right. It did change Gabby Giffords.
Oh, yes.
Well, I think she had already been... I'm not sure. I think she had already been...
On the gun control side?
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, obviously. But yeah, Laura's right. It doesn't always change minds. No. It can, but doesn't always.
It's that political dynamic. It's in play.
Can I get reelected if I do this?
Yeah. Mm.
And the NRA endorsement drives voters to vote yes or no for candidates.
And that's another thing. A lot of people think it's the NRA money, but it's the endorsement that is what matters the most.
And I think there are people who want to get reelected not just because they want to support gun rights, but because they feel that they're doing other things that are really good. And the only way they can continue to do those things is to continue to get an NRA endorsement or to continue to side, say, with President Trump or something like that. They want to continue to do the work they feel is important, and that's the only way they feel they can get reelected to do those things.
Yeah, if you're not there, you can't do anything.
Exactly. Right.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also, Marty Schladen of the Columbus Dispatch and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking Ohio politics on our weekly reporter roundtable. So with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen, Dayton Daily News reporter Laura Bischoff, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. I want to talk about the opioid settlement. Governor Mike DeWine met with about 100 city and county elected officials and their lawyers at the governor's residence, along with Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. It was the first of its kind meeting among, in the state, among those seeking damages from opioid manufacturers and distributors. What's the sense about how this is going to work, Karen Kassler?
Well, I think there was a little bit of a struggle that happened over the summer where Attorney General Dave Yost had tried to step in and delay this big trial that was supposed to start last week in Cleveland by saying that he and a couple of other attorneys general in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce were arguing that states should be the ones that were in that lawsuit and leading that lawsuit, not the 2,600 local communities, the counties and cities and other entities that were involved in that suit. He had tried to stop that trial with that claim. That didn't work. And then the trial ended up not going forward at the last minute because of a settlement with the two bellwether counties, Cuyahoga County and Summit County. But I think there's been this struggle back and forth over what's going to happen to all that money? Because a lot of people have memories of the 1998 Master Tobacco settlement and how that money was used for budget deficits and to fix
schools.
And they
were able to do that because they sold bonds. How did that work?
Well, they did a couple of different rounds of when that money came to the state. Then they did some things with repairing schools and budgets issues and whatever. And then they did end up selling off $8 billion of future payments for $5 billion. But the whole point of it is that eventually there wasn't the money there to fight smoking-related illnesses and you know, the things that people are dealing with in Medicaid and Medicare, or Medicaid, rather, with the costs of all that. So, you know, the idea is to try to figure out how are we going to not only try to help these counties and cities that have been dealing with this crisis, but also try to preserve some money. So if this morphs into another drug crisis, then we'll still have money to help with all that and to help, you know, the kids in the foster care system. And,
well, there's
and
no
all
magic
that
wand, bottom line, is just because they won this suit doesn't mean the opioid crisis goes away.
Absolutely
it's
not.
Easily could uptick again.
Right. And I think that Governor DeWine has been saying that he thinks that, you know, there should be a united front by all these entities, and that the bulk of the money should go to the locals, which have really had to bear the brunt of the response, the first responders, the court systems, mental health providers, et cetera. And you're right, the opioid crisis is not over. It is continuing.
Could be decades.
It's generational, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And Yost took a fair amount of heat from the locals when he not only tried this legal action, but also then backed a bill that the legislature that was in draft form that said that state lawmakers were going to be able to control about 90% of the money that would come in these settlements, and no less than 20% would go to local communities. Now, I asked him about that at a Columbus Metropolitan Club forum.
Like where he came up with that number?
Well, yeah, I asked him about that bill, and you know, counties then responded by saying it was a power grab. They thought it was a power cash grab. He had said earlier he thought it was a power grab for locals to go and do the actions that they did in terms of federal court and try to lead on this case that he felt the state should be arguing. So, but he's really backed off this idea of state lawmakers having the ability to control where the money would go. The bill never went anywhere. And he's been saying very clearly since then that he feels that local communities do need to get the bulk of this funding. That does lead, though, to the other question, what happens to individuals
right.
who might want to.
They're not part of
in?
Any of this.
No, they're not.
It's highly unlikely. I mean, they're not. They don't get a piece of this.
I don't see any way they could, but I think that might preserve their ability to make a claim of their own, either through a class action or individually in the courts. You know, but back to the governor's gathering at the governor's mansion, I certainly hope with all those people around the table, one of the things they were discussing were sort of guardrails for these monies so that they're not treated the way the tobacco monies were. Because a lot of these local governments, you got to think they're already in economically depressed areas. They need every penny they can get just to keep the lights on. And does that mean that this money is going to be used in any sort of coherent way to alleviate this particular crisis instead of all the other crises they're faced with?
Well, I mean, in Summit County, they say, you know, obviously we started out with two relatively wealthy counties because they're big city counties, Summit and Cuyahoga. And they said, I talked with the Summit County people last week and they said, absolutely not. It's going to be written into their local legislation. It's already been clearly, defined about how the money can be spent. But you're right, in these less wealthy areas, what of them? And I'm also wondering, is there any sense that there'll be repercussions in terms of state funding if one of these subdivisions, you know, gets this what might be perceived as a windfall? Well, then the states say, well, they're part of one of the settlement counties or cities, or, you know, so we don't, you know, when it comes to divvying up state funding, is it just going to be a loss, you know, or a net?
That's interesting.
I think that will depend on how the state's doing. If the state, yeah. if the state has an economic crisis, then, you know, a lot of times they want to push the pain down the road so that they can balance the budget.
And I think I talked to the governor right after at the residence right after that meeting. And one of the reasons that he'd wanted to have this was not only to try to put those guardrails in place and try to get a sense of, as a unified front, how are we going to use the money, but also to make sure that the smaller counties who were not part of that lawsuit, or who were not Cuyahoga County and Summit County, you know, the Jackson counties and Scioto counties that have really been hit very hard by this too, how can we make sure that they are also taken care of and they get a share of this funding as well? Because when Judge Daniel Polster in federal court in Cleveland, he created this negotiation class that allowed for any city and county in the country to be a part of the settlement unless they opt out of it. And now Attorney General Dave Yost doesn't think that has any legal background whatsoever. He says that the judge kind of invented that, but because apparently it's the first time it's been done. But still the idea of how do you bring in counties who did not file legal action because they couldn't afford it or because they just weren't part of it, how mm-hmm. but still have suffered from this, how do you bring them in and allow them to at least get something out of this when other counties are also getting some relief as well?
And one of the things this might be pointing out is that nobody's really shaped a good comprehensive strategy for dealing with it. We call it the opioid epidemic, but it's metastasizing already into, you know, methamphetamine and all these other things, and fentanyl, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an opioid, but mm-hmm. I guess that's really the thing that lurks behind all of this, is what does the solution look like? Do we even know?
And does it look the same in a Summit County as it would in a Scioto County?
That's a really – I don't think it does. And so how do you come up with broad – and I think that's why Marty's right about the idea of guardrails. How do you – you've got to come up with guardrails where at least you know where the boundaries are, how you overall are going to be spending this money. But then specifically, what are you going to do? Well, then that's kind of up to individual counties based on what they need.
I also wonder about individuals, though. You know, this is cut across socioeconomic lines, but a lot of people still are rendered very destitute from addiction. I'm wondering, you know, you're talking about maybe a class action is what you were saying, that they may be able to band together and there's nothing that would stop them from doing that.
I suppose, though, in order to be a part of that class, you would have to show that you were somehow wronged by the prescription opioid supply chain. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just be somebody who partied a lot in high school
right.
and, you know, ended up on heroin.
But especially a lot of the early cases, I mean, that is exactly what happened, is it wasn't that they were partying. They were usually an athlete. They were injured. They got hooked on opioids.
I think the stats is that it's like 80% of people who are addicted to opioids, that their first exposure came through prescriptions.
And then a failure to monitor and address the addiction issues.
And I think the state's done a pretty good job of, putting better guardrails up on that. The Ohio automated prescription drug monitoring program, the ORS database, has been beefed up. There's been more restrictions on prescription writing for short-term acute needs, chronic pain, more monitoring of chronic pain doctors and clinics. There's been, you know, a big effort to shut down pill mills. So I think that the prescription drug side, there has been a lot of work, and I think the Kasich administration did a lot of work on that side. But then it, you know, like you said, it morphs, it metastasizes, and it goes into heroin, then to fentanyl, and then carfentanil, and now it's back to methamphetamines, you know.
Right. It's running the gamut.
And if you look at the autopsy reports, like we did, I guess it was in 18, there are multiple drugs in people's systems. So, you know, these overdose deaths are not just heroin or fentanyl.
I wanted to turn to a little news on the presidential side of things. Tim Ryan, Ohio's member of Congress from Ohio, has dropped out of the presidential race last week. He was not on the panel during the debate at Otterbein University. He's going to run for re-election. did this run of his for the nomination, do you have a sense about whether it gave him any cachet that he wouldn't have otherwise had, Karen Kassler?
I think his problem was that he was looking for a lane that was currently occupied. I mean, I think that there were, I mean, Joe Biden is obviously one in that lane, but there were other candidates who were also in that kind of moderate to center left area that, you know, I think he was trying to move into that. He made two of the four debates, I think it was. He was not going to make – he didn't make the one at Otterbein, like you said. He was probably not – he wasn't going to make the one that's coming next month in Atlanta. And so his fundraising had really dropped dramatically. It was like half of what it had been in the last fundraising period. So it seemed – likely that he was going to drop out. There are people who will point to that he's run for a lot of things and has not. I mean, he ran against Speaker Nancy Pelosi a couple years ago, there's been long talk about him running for governor of Ohio and things like that, but that he's always one of those that people talk about, but then is not end up being the lead candidate. But I think it's been something that you know, he's tried to parlay it into a discussion about agriculture, discussion about blue-collar workers, some of the same things that even Sherrod Brown has talked about in the past, and there's still talk about him joining in a late entry into the Democratic race. So,
I was going to say President Trump kind of
Why would he even pay attention to Tim Ryan dropping out?
He called him registering a zero in the polls, unable to qualify for the debate stage. See, Tim, it's not so easy out there, et cetera. And I thought Tim Ryan's response was pretty good. He posted a photo of the Lordstown plant and said, "This is the view from where I live, Mr. President. Empty parking lot. Used to be thousands of jobs, all on your watch."
And that's interesting because Trump did well in that area.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, he didn't win Mahoning County, but I believe he won Columbiana County. And that's an area that a lot of people have been watching.
He did pretty well in Mahoning County, though, did he not?
Comparatively. But that's an area that a lot of folks have been watching and wanted to see how, for instance, Senator Sherrod Brown would do when he was up for re-election last year to see whether that was an area that was, you know, it had been blue for a long time, whether it was turning to red or whether it would go back to blue. And so, you know, him being from that area, I think it's significant. Trump has done a couple rallies out there, not recently, but during 2016, he did a couple rallies out there and it ended up paying off for him.
You were at the debate.
I was there for a brief period, but mostly my colleagues, Joe Ingalls and Annie Chow. Okay. I did wander around because it's Otterbein and I went there. Yeah. And it's just kind of fun. So.
I avoided it like the plague.
For the same reason.
Because the parking, you know, unless you could just Uber or Lyft in, it was tough. Laura Bischoff, what is your sense about the debate and how it rolled out?
Well, I have to say, kudos to Otterbein. They did a great job. Yeah. The logistics were really smooth. Westerville was very... It was super picturesque. I mean, they had the mums out, the pumpkins. It looked so, you know, fall
so
festival.
It was beautiful. Yeah. That's, and the renovation, what they did in, you know, the facilities, extraordinary. Really good.
Yeah. The last time I was in that Westerville or in the Otterbein gym, my son was pole vaulting. And it was a complete transformation from that. I thought that the debate, you know, it was interesting. It was a great way for Ohio to showcase. The Democrats had a press conference ahead of that with Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, and kind of like the Ohio farm team, Nan Whaley, John Cranley, the mayors. They made a point of trying to point out that Donald Trump has broken promises to Ohio, like telling Youngstown, don't sell your house. The jobs are coming back and now Lordstown is closed. Or we're going to build a great new bridge to replace the Brent Spence Bridge in Cincinnati. That hasn't happened. You know, he promised right after the Dayton shootings that, you know, he was going to look into it. He was going to make some changes and then he backtracked on that. So it was an opportunity for the Democrats to make their points.
I think in the debate itself, Elizabeth Warren kind of went in as the front runner and she got nicked up a bit because she hasn't figured out yet how to answer the question, how do you pay for Medicare for all? I think what she's afraid of is writing a campaign commercial for somebody else, particularly a Republican, saying Liz Warren says she wants to raise your taxes. She's going to have to figure that out. And I think that, two people trying to run in the moderate lane did themselves, you know,
did themselves some favors, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. I think that they came out of the debate and got a little bump in the poll. So, you know, at least I think that's the political upshot of it.
Well, we will continue our conversation at a later date. But for now, I thank you for joining us. Karen Kassler from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Great to be with y'all.
And Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News.
Always a pleasure.
And Marty Sladen of the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks,
Ann.
You bet. Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.